Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlossophers.
Arr, and hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlossophers. That's right, we are on open seas tonight as we have a huge discussion talking about the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. And so, of course, talking about the Pirates of the Caribbean, it's only a natural response to go arr. I mean, every single joke and pun and just nautical humor that can be utilized tonight will probably be utilized. So anchor down and get ready to get into some swashbuckling of the minds, shall we?
Swashbuckling of the minds.
The Filmlossophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week aboard the Black Pearl. Or in a small soundproof room at VGB Studios.
One or the other. I mean, they're both really cool.
I was going to say, technically, they both really are the same. Yo-ho, yo-ho, if the Pirate's Life is for you, then don't forget to stay in touch.
Arr!
Subscribe for new episodes of The Filmlossophers every Wednesday morning on Player FM, Audio Boom, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, and Libsyn. And it doesn't actually just have to be Wednesday. You can do it Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
You can subscribe anytime you'd like.
But that is when we have fresh new episodes readily available for you. Wondering where all the rum has gone? Connect with us on social media to find out. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlossophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlossophy101 for more opportunities to connect. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and Me, Mike, Self, and I. Yeah, like I said, we're going to be getting into some deep waters, if you will, with this one, and just really discussing just what it is that makes the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise so unique. So I hope you're ready to kind of get into some conversations, get into some discussions, and of course, get a little mentally messy. So, diving right
I'm
in.
I'm ready.
I know
you,
I am.
Are you talking to me? I'm ready.
You know, you can't actually have a discussion, however, of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise without having this theme song. I think anytime you hear this song, you immediately think of, like, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Absolutely.
Or to some other people, maybe Jack Sparrow. I mean, we did have Kristen on the show not too long ago, and she was a...
Yep.
She was a
big
fiend.
Big fan.
A fiend, if you will, for Jack Sparrow, so... this song is synonymous with this, but we're not just talking about a character. We're not just talking about a movie. We're not just talking about that. We are talking about the franchise. And one of the great things that has come out of cinema since the great days of black and white films have been sagas. Films that have a connective tendon running through them, giving moviegoers an opportunity to see a world much bigger than the silver screen. From the very first sequel ever in cinema history, 1916's The Fall of a Nation, which, if you can guess, what do you think that's the sequel to?
Birth of a Nation?
There you go! You win a prize! To modern-day franchises, cinema has come a long way in terms of making cinematic universes. Some of the more common ones many moviegoers may be more familiar with are the ones such as the MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe, the DCEU, which we talked about last week, with Wonder Woman, even novel-based franchises such as The Hunger Games and the Divergent series. So in lieu of the recent release of its fifth installment, we're going to take a look at one of the most popular live-action franchises to come out of Disney, which is Mary Poppins.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
There's a lot of drawn-out vowels there.
I mean, Jeffrey Rush is the king.
True.
Of pirate speak. I mean, I know that Johnny Depp has his whole, like, mannerisms and everything, and everybody loves that. That's very winsome. But Barbossa is where it's at in terms of getting your pirate speaking pattern going.
It's true. I'm not going to lie. I was not really familiar with Jeffrey Rush prior to Pirates of the Caribbean, just because before...
Oh, how young they are. Oh, how young they are these days.
You know what?
These people, though, just sit anybody at this microphone.
True. Very true. I mean, hey.
You had never known Jeffrey Rush before, Barbossa?
No, I'm not going to lie. I don't remember his name coming up. I'm pretty sure if I've seen the film, but him in terms of his work, personally, I wasn't really all that familiar. I'm actually going through his stuff right now. I mean, other than...
I mean, I guess I'll give you a little bit of a help, a handout, because it was 2003 when The Curse of the Black Pearl came out, which was the first film in the saga.
True.
In the series. Although at the time, they didn't know for sure that it was going to be a saga. It was a really big risk because it's an entire movie based on a ride at a theme park.
True. Not just any ride, but it is actually based on the hit ride at Disneyland.
And Disney World.
And Disney World.
Share the love.
You know what?
I grew up going to Disney World every like 5 or 6 years because it's expensive. And what, you're going to turn my mic off? Is that what you're motioning?
No. I was going to say, but in terms of location of where we are now, we are closer to the one in Disneyland.
But you don't know where our listeners might be. They might be anywhere.
True.
All I'm saying is I did also ride Pirates of the Caribbean, and I didn't visit Disneyland until I was in my 20s.
Mm. Well, based on the hit ride at Disneyland and Disney World,
thank you.
Pirates of the Caribbean is a fantastical world of pirates and swashbucklers, krakens and giant whirlpools, and of course, Johnny Depp. So
for better or worse, so, we wouldn't have it without him.
It's true. I mean, you can say as much as you want, and we're going to get into it, and we're going to really discuss his contributions or takeaways from the film franchise and really get into the nitty-gritty. So, you know, let's just jump right in and see what kinds of things made this franchise to be the powerhouse it has become. So, unless you've been living under a rock, this film franchise has been going on since 2003, like you said, and there's already currently five films. With the current release.
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of summarize it real quick, from the first film, which is Pirates of the Caribbean, the Curse of the Black Pearl, through Dead Man's Chest, which is the second one. And then I'm going back and forth in terms of information here.
I'm like, you have it listed right here.
Dead Man's Chest and At World's End. The storyline running through that is you have the introduction of characters such as Elizabeth Swan, who belongs to a more affluent society or a more higher society.
Yeah, her father's the governor or whatever.
And you have Will Turner, who is a blacksmith who was found in a wreckage, a ship wreckage, when they were younger, and she has this, you know, slight affinity towards him. He recognizes somewhat his place in the world and keeps his head down and builds swords. And then we're introduced to Jack Sparrow, who,
sure,
in very much
Captain Jack Sparrow.
Captain Jack Sparrow, who comes in on a ship that's sinking.
Best entrance by a mile in any film in the last 20 years.
True. And so he comes in, he swindles his way into getting the boat tied up without him having to do paperwork, and comes to blows with Will Turner in terms of him being chased by the soldiers that are there because,
sure,
he took somebody hostage. They come to blows. You have your first aha moment where he has a gun pointing at, you know, Will Turner. He says, you know, this bullet isn't meant for you. First aha moment. And so the film continues where the whole town is bombarded by pirates, ghost pirates, and they steal Elizabeth Swan. And so Jack Sparrow and Will Turner go on this huge adventure to go and locate her. Obviously, the film turns out successful because they had subsequent films. But the film doesn't really have a connective piece between the first film and the second film. I'm just going to say that right now.
Well, the first film was kind of to stand alone if it had to. If it didn't make money in the box office, then it wouldn't feel incomplete.
True. And so that's very apparent because the film ends on...
Aside from the fact that they do kind of drop hints that there is a story for Will Turner's father True. It comes up every once in a while in the first film, and you start to pay it off then with the sequels that came later.
Yeah, so they are able to save Elizabeth. Elizabeth and Will, you know, realize their affection for each other. Jack ends up taking off on a boat, and the first film ends. Second film begins with the call, so to speak, the call that goes out, where pirates are getting hung because of what they do and whatnot. And so the call goes out, and so they're amassing an army to fight against the pirates and eradicate them. And Jack Sparrow, who knows the mark is on him of some sort, there's a mark, ends up going and getting his friends so that they can go and grab the rest of the pirates and convince them that they need to fight against these this armada.
The Imperial powers.
But at the same time, Jack Sparrow is being pursued by Davy Jones because the mark that is on him is from Davy Jones. And so Davy Jones is coming to collect what is his and store in his locker.
Right.
So
Davy Jones, the like squid-faced, octopus-faced, creepy, scary pirate guy.
Man, could you be any nicer? Squid-faced, I mean, pirate-faced.
And he plays the son organ with all those and tentacles and everything. Creepy.
I mean, but you got to admit.
Keeps having, his heart in a box?
Having Bill Nighy
creepy.
As the actor who plays Davy Jones.
He did a great job.
He did. And so that film ends with Elizabeth Swann sacrificing Jack to subside a kraken whom Davy Jones sent after them. And so the end of that has Jack being eaten and
right.
the other guys getting away, which includes people like Elizabeth, Will Turner, and a few other bandits, bandidos, pirates, whatever.
Right. Mr. Gibbs.
True.
You know.
So the third film.
Who has managed to hang on for all of these films.
Yeah. Honestly, for somebody who. Yeah.
Mr. I mean, hats off to Gibbs. You meet him in a pig trough.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
The first one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So the third film begins where they are trying to connect with this Chinese pirate played by Chow Yun-fat.
Right.
And apparently...
Xiao Fang.
Yes, and apparently someone had gone to try to talk to him or steal something from him prior to that, and they find out it was Will Turner, and so they have to finagle that conversation, and they end up getting away, running off, whatever. All the while, Jack Sparrow is in this no man's like
weird
land.
Weird limbo land.
It really is like weird.
Super, super weird.
Like, almost like artistic weird, like... This,
yeah, like trying to be avant-garde.
Exactly.
He's talking to himself.
He's licking rocks.
That are actually crabs.
Yeah.
That when they band together, they can
move a ship.
A ship. It was very odd.
So ultimately, they figure out a way. They find a way to bring Jack back, if you will.
Jack's back.
And so...
And they've got the whole Pirate Council thing going on and the Pieces of Eight.
With Keith Richards...
Finally making an appearance since he was the
father of,
well, he was the influence on Johnny Depp's performance style from the beginning.
So they're able to bring them all together. They band all these pirates together. They fight this armada, end up defeating the armada. And in the midst of that, Will is trying to fight to get his father freed from Davy Jones.
Bootstrap Bill.
Bootstrap Bill. And in the midst of that, all the kerfluffle and all the craziness, Will ends up sacrificing himself to save everybody else by becoming the new Davy Jones.
Essentially, yes.
Essentially. That's what's kind of, you know, hinted at. So that's kind of how the whole film ends. You
well,
get
they
this
have a big showdown with... Tia Dalma, who actually ends up being some kind of a sea witch deity monster
yes.
thing.
She's like this voodoo witch from out yonder, which, I'm sorry, at the end of the film, that's when that voodoo witch ends up having Jeffrey Rush reemerge.
Sure.
To help them find Chow Yun-fat and bring Jack back and all that kind of stuff. So, yes, she has this really brief.
She has this huge, like, Ursula from The Little Mermaid moment where she's giant and you've got boats, you know, circling around her.
Yeah.
And everybody's on ropes flying from one boat to the other, or ship, actually. I shouldn't say boat because they're, like, full-on pirate ships. They're shooting cannons at each other in the middle of a whirlpool. It's crazy.
Yeah. And so in the midst of all that, and then Will gets stabbed, and in order to save him, Elizabeth decides to cut his heart out to put into the box that Chad was mentioning earlier so that he could become Davy Jones. Everything subsides. You know, they're able to defeat all them, and everything kind of goes back.
Well, because as it turns out, the voodoo witch lady was the woman that Davy Jones had loved.
And after that little romance turned cold, he decided he would never love again and cut his heart out, and so that he could never... That whole debacle. So
it's surprisingly complicated for as straightforward as the presentation is.
As straightforward as we tried to present it to you.
Well, I don't know about that. But I mean, like, you've got your, you know, your sword fights and your fighting on the giant wheel, and you know, you're obviously time at sea and pirates that have barnacles growing on them, and pirates that turn into ghost zombie things in the moonlight. And I mean, the presentation is pretty straightforward in terms of, you know, what you're looking at. However, the story elements turned out to be quite dense in that original trilogy, if you will.
True.
And there was a lot going on by the end of it.
Yeah. And so
some say too much.
True.
I'm one of those.
And so after everything subsides, and there's this final scene that you see where Elizabeth ended up apparently having a baby. It's
because the whole thing of he doesn't become the new Davy Jones. He becomes the new whatever there's a title for it, but he can only come back into the living world once every 7 years or something like that. So basically they were together before he finally, like, assumed the duties of the captain of... It's the captain of the Jolly Roger, right?
Yes.
Is it the Jolly Roger?
Yes.
Yeah. So that he didn't become the new Davy Jones.
Sorry, the Flying Dutchman.
The Flying Dutchman. Thank you. Well, I'm getting so excited I'm hitting the microphone.
That he is.
So he became the captain of the Flying Dutchman instead of Davy Jones. And along with that, he only is able to come up to the surface of the living world once every 7 years. So when he comes back in the cutscene at the end of the third movie, it's been 7 years, and she now has their child.
Yes.
With her to meet his father for the first time.
What I'm reading here is apparently Will becomes a sort of psychopomp of somebody who ferries people to the other side.
Okay.
He doesn't.
So like
he doesn't,
Acheron in Greek mythology or something.
So he doesn't necessarily become Davy Jones. Davy Jones is just the name of the pirate who held that position.
Was doing it before him. Yeah.
Yes. He becomes a sort of ferryman who, you know, helps escort people to the other side. And so you get that final scene in the end credits of that film where Elizabeth Swann is holding their baby right by the edge of the sea, and then you see him come by on his ship, and he's got barnacles on the side of his face or whatever, but he's looking out and he sees his son. So that's pretty much the way that film goes. So after that trilogy, whatever,
and then everybody thought it was over.
True.
For a good while, people were like, oh, okay, that was weird, but at least it's done.
I was hoping it would have been over, but it wasn't. So apparently they come out with another film a few years later called Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. And in this one, Jack Sparrow and Barbossa actually both seek out the Fountain of Youth, while at the same time, Blackbeard, played by Ian McShane, and his daughter, played by Penelope Cruz, are also looking after it too and trying to find it. So you have these two teams that are kind of racing to, you know, get to this goal. That's where you get that scene where they're trying to climb up in this bone cage or whatever in the beginning of the film.
Right.
That whole thing.
Well, they have a really interesting, like, street chase in the streets of London because Jack is going to be prosecuted and tried and whatnot, and then they get him out. And Or no, Mr. Gibbs's. Hold on.
No, it was him.
It was him? Okay.
Because he's brought in front of these people.
Obviously, we did not watch that one recently.
No.
And then in it, he ends up meeting himself. So Jack fights Jack, but the other Jack is Penelope Cruz wearing a fake mustache.
Mm-hmm.
That was very interesting. Funny and odd, but interesting. So, and then they go off on In Search of the Fountain of Youth.
Which, honestly, that's kind of hinted at, if now that I'm thinking about it, it's kind of hinted at the end of the third film.
Sure.
When he has that map that has all the pieces that move, and it's, you know, he finds the Fountain of Youth on there. You're kind of hoping that it's just like a far-off thought, like let the moviegoer's mind kind of take it from there.
Sure.
But
They didn't.
And so you have both of those, you know, sides going after this, you know, legendary location, all the while experiencing things like evil mermaids, like crazy looking evil mermaids, probably the scariest thing I've ever seen in a Walt Disney film, because I've never seen, I mean, Little Mermaid didn't show me any of that, and I'm watching it and I'm like, I will never step foot in water again.
And they end up taking one of them.
Yeah, like comes right up to the boat, grabs him and pulls him under. I'm like, oh, this just
No. I mean, they take a mermaid with them. The pirates take a mermaid.
Oh, that's right.
And they're carrying her
because
in,
the
like,
tear,
water and whatever, yeah.
Because the tear of a mermaid does something.
Sure.
She's totally
like a captive. And then they've got what's-his-face, Finnick from the Hunger Games.
That's right.
Before he was Finnick from the Hunger Games, he was the new Will Turner.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, not, he wasn't literally Will Turner, but he filled the role of the Will Turner style character.
Yes, yes.
And he was in love with the mermaid girl.
Whom first, apparently it's so difficult to get a tear from a mermaid or whatever, and so they use him to force a tear out of her, and they collect it. Apparently it does something unique. Either way, so...
Apparently it does something unique.
So that whole, debacle of a film happened. As you can tell, it didn't leave as much of a lasting impact as the first three. So, I mean, so let's just jump right in. Obviously, that's the gist of what we've seen so far. And we're sad to say we haven't seen the latest film, but...
I'm not sad to say it.
Depending on how this conversation goes...
We haven't seen this film yet.
Depending on how this conversation goes, we'll see how, I mean, if we can fit it into our schedule and watch
how.
It. How? But, okay, yeah. So, starting at the top, I have to say, I find it kind of annoying how the first film, and mind you, I can see how, kind of like how Lord of the Rings, not many people thought that after that they were going to really be that successful, so they made all the films in one clean sweep, and they...
They filmed all three of them back to back to back.
And they after the success of the first one, they kind of revisited. But it's like, if you're going to plan, in my mind, if you're a filmmaker and you're working with one of the biggest companies in the world, like Disney, if you're going to dream big. And if you're creating a movie like this, why not think further down the road? And in my mind, it was great to see how this film worked and to see all the great things they included in it, but... That connective tissue, that tendon that I was talking about earlier, it's really super thin coming from that first film to the second film. It's almost like they're reaching just to start that second film. Like, oh, by the way, while we're in this universe, we're going to start massacring all these pirates. And as this is happening, the call, quote unquote call, is going to go out for all the pirates to band together for one last hurrah. You know, it just seemed a bit reaching to me.
Which is that's totally normal. I don't know that they had. I mean, they would probably argue with us on this, but it didn't seem that they had a three film plan so much as they had options that they could explore if the first film did well. Again, they left the first film pretty well closed, not in a like fully can't continue the story way, but in a complete. Feeling complete kind of way, so that if it didn't make money, that would be it. Although, to your point, not only did they have one big production company, they actually had two.
That's right.
Because Bruckheimer Films and Disney were partnered together on this one, and that was a big part of the story. because you know you had, I guess, the intellectual property of Pirates of the Caribbean that was Disney, a lot of money from Disney, but you also were mixing in that kind of rough and tumble action element that is present in a lot of Jerry Bruckheimer films.
That's true.
And it was there. I mean, it was clearly there. There was a lot of rough and tumble. There were lots of sword fights and running and
oh yeah,
rowing boats and swimming and shooting cannons and all kinds of things going on.
In this case, so I have to say, this film had all the right, hit all the right notes. So if we're looking at the trilogy, we'll get to the fourth film eventually. But in terms of this first trilogy, so I have to say the first film really does a great job in terms of creating a solid balance of character exposure as well as the storytelling element. Yeah. One of the things that I was talking about with someone today is one of the things that really stands out to me for this film is you can tell they set out to create a solid, taken seriously type of film for Disney and Bruckheimer Films. With the names that are behind this and the names that are in it, I mean, at the time, Johnny Depp wasn't doing much else. This kind of revamped his whole career. But people like Orlando Bloom, who was still riding high on the success of, you know, Lord of the Rings, like we just mentioned, people like Keira Knightley.
Well, kind of. I mean, they were happening in tandem.
Yeah, yeah.
He wasn't really a known quantity.
No, but at the time with him having that notoriety of being known as Legolas and like, oh, the guy who plays Legolas, he's also doing the Pirates of the Caribbean second film and third film or whatever. I mean, the infamy was there. But
oh, you're on to the second and third film already. I was thinking of the first one. He really wasn't that known. I mean, like, you knew that he was going to be in the Lord of the Rings movies, but they weren't out yet, I don't think.
Ah, you might be right.
I think for the first film, I think this was basically his first big, like, tentpole style film. But at any rate, it worked. One of the things that you would not have gotten with just Disney, if you had no Bruckheimer involved and it was just Disney, you would have had a much tamer story. You probably wouldn't have actually gotten away with Jack Sparrow the way that we know him.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have had as much of a dark color palette probably. And you know, just some of those filmmaking touches that made it really great and enjoyable are because you had the fusion of two different production houses working together.
Yeah.
And you were able to leverage some of your lesser known talent with some of your more well known, but not, I mean, Johnny Depp was a known name ever since 21 Jump Street, but he kind of had faded a little bit into pseudo obscurity.
Oh yeah.
He hadn't really done anything high profile
other than a vague Tim
recently,
Burton film,
you know,
or anything.
That. Yeah. I mean, obviously, yes, he is Tim Burton's main man.
That is true.
But you know, like, he wasn't, a lot of those still are, you know, niche audiences.
Yeah.
You know, for even a new installment from Tim Burton. So, I mean, it was definitely a risk and it really paid off.
Yeah. And looking here, actually, Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship, and The Two Towers were 2001 and 2002. So,
okay.
So prior to that, I think led to part of bringing somebody like that to the forefront for this film. But then even somebody, we were talking about it earlier, Jeffrey Rush, you know, a well-known actor prior to this time, mm-hmm. apparently. No,
he was.
I'm just kidding.
Oscar nominated, at least. I don't know if he had, did he win before?
No, he's done.
He was nominated.
Oh, yeah. No. But to have somebody with that type of background playing something like this in this film, like, okay, well, let's have Jeffrey Rush play. Let's have him play this verbose pirate who leads these ghost guys and they go and do mischief and whatnot, craziness. I mean, pitching that in a boardroom is like, so we're going to have this very well-known English actor look like he just, you know, rolled over in a dirt, you know, area, whatever, and whatnot. And I just,
after going through a cheese grater,
exactly,
and yeah, having some like dry rub like embedded in his skin,
exactly,
slow baked on a rotisserie.
Oh my gosh, his face looked
all kinds of awful.
But
and it gets worse as the movie goes on. The movie's gone, which is great. Like, I, for whatever reason, well, I know the reason. It's because it's Jeffrey Rush, and he's having fun, and you can tell that he's having fun with the role. But Barbossa is by far my favorite character in this franchise.
Oh, no doubt. I have to agree fully because of the
fact... all of you Jack Sparrow lovers.
Exactly.
He's got nothing on Barbossa.
That's true. And when you have somebody who can just command a scene like him and just come out and just... You know he's having fun when he blends so well into the character. You forget. This is probably... I'm pretty sure it's true. I'm just stating it out there, so somebody's going to correct me probably will. But... They're having somebody who I'm pretty sure has a background in theater and performing arts.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And to come out and just, you know, totally pirate it up with all these guys and blend in so well. I mean, yeah, you can't help but not fall in love with that type of character. Yes, Johnny Depp does that as well, but you have somebody like Jeffrey Rush. I mean, come on, they're potatoes, you know, tomatoes, everything totally different, you know, totally.
Well, and you wouldn't have, I mean, it's just like any great, you know, oppositional force where the hero and the villain in great matchups, they influence each other. Like the hero is better and the villain is better in their respective roles when there's, when they're both, you know, great and well-written, well-cast, and the performers are really giving it their all. And in the first film, you had that for sure. I mean, you've got Jack doing his quirky, weird stuff that he does all over the place. And then you've got Barbossa with his eye rolls and his sighs and his, you know, all of the little nuances that he puts into it that are just super enjoyable to watch.
And it's interesting because looking at one of the writers on the film, you got somebody like Ted Elliott. Ted Elliott, if you're unfamiliar with the name, was part of the writing team that created The Lone Ranger, the recent one. Pretty much every Pirates of the Caribbean movie. And he even did the Zorro films, The Mask of Zorro and The Legend of Zorro. You have to admit, there is a slight similarity in terms of the way scenes are written. If you're a fan, like, which I am, and I'm pretty sure Chad is as well, of like those Zorro films, the way the scene and the action sequences and the way it's just visioned out.
Sure.
You can totally see similarities there. But to have somebody like Gore Verbinski, who is known for his unique films, you know, I remember seeing The Mexican, with Brad Pitt and
Julie Roberts.
And that was a really weird and unique film, but it was still an interesting piece of cinema. And then to have him do all the Pirates of the Caribbean movie and then do another Johnny Depp movie, which was Rango, he just has a very quirky style of directing film. And I think if it wasn't for him, the films probably would have went off the rails at some point, and it wouldn't have been the unique vision that it became.
Sure, because he did the first two. Verbinski, he directed the first two. And what's really great about, when you look at a bunch of his live-action films, Rango is kind of an outlier.
Yeah.
Oddball. But the live-action films, when you look at them, I mean, he's really, really good at scene composition. And I don't know if he just hires amazing cinematographers.
Yeah.
But just the texture that's there, I mean, the depth of field, like how far into the background you can see in certain scenes, the lighting, all the elements that a lot of times you can take for granted.
Yeah.
And with a budget like Disney, you could sure like cheat if you wanted to, but he and his team didn't. The colors, the textures, the different like raw elements like fire in the background or whatever. I mean, there's just the dirt on their faces, the way that it all the costuming works. It all creates a very visually rich frame for you to be referencing in any given scene of any of the films, really. But, you know, the first one set the tone for sure for everything that came after.
True. And so this is kind of a step away from the format that we're talking about. But one of his first films that he's ever directed was Mouse Hunt. Now, I don't know if you remember that film. But Mouse Hunt had Nathan Lane. It had Lee Evans. Mind you, it's just literally two guys who inherit a house, an antique house, and the house has one mouse. And the whole film is them trying to get rid of it. But mind you, the storyline is just ridiculous. But the way these scenes are put together, it's almost like Gore Verbinski and Dr. Seuss were kind of the same mind in terms of creating a composition of a scene that you didn't really expect to see. Like, you're watching a courtroom, and within the courtroom, you're also in your line of sight. You see this woman who is being nervous because you're seeing this person doing this and you're watching that. He's able to include all these different elements in a scene and still make it work. And you can tell that somebody who does things like that, I mean, was such a great choice.
Or he'll film it for the punchline.
Exactly.
A la Jack Sparrow's entry scene. I mean, you see him, it looks like he is at the top, you know, the top of this giant ship with the sun rising or setting. I don't remember which one. Behind him, there's this heroic music. He's got a pose. I mean, there's wind. It's amazing. And as he continues to move toward the dock, the camera is backing out to show you that the ship is almost completely sunk.
Yeah.
And in fact, does completely sink when he reaches the dock and he just steps right off, you know, onto the dock. But I mean, like, that's so clever and so creative to make sure that you know everything you need to know about this character.
Oh yeah.
Right from the start.
And it's just one of those things where that particular introduction, so there's been a lot of introductions of characters, and some of them, you know, span back to, you know, like we were talking about, the black and white days of cinema. I have to say, this is probably one of the more unique and smarter introductions to have to a character, especially when you have no clue at the time. You have no clue of the nature of this pirate. You have no clue of the nature of this individual. So from what you're seeing, your first glance is, like you said, oh, this is somebody who's commanding a ship. He's somebody who is of, you know, has a, you know, a unique position on his, you know, detail or whatever. And to have that kind of jump back to the punchline and you see, oh, he's actually on a, you know, drowning ship.
Yeah. Well, he's a bit of a court jester, mm-hmm, kind of a character. And you didn't, I can't remember. I mean, it's been a few years, 14 to be exact, but I don't remember a whole lot of the marketing before the movie came out, the first one, The Curse of the Black Pearl. But I don't recall them giving too much of the game away with Jack Sparrow. That was more something that you discovered delightfully in the movie theater. Like, you discovered how quirky he is. I don't remember them really forewarning you about that in a way.
And no.
Forewarning's not even the word. They didn't spoil it for you. It was something that you got to experience firsthand right from that moment. And you're saying, oh, this guy's goofy. That's really fun and enjoyable.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that's interesting about it in terms of looking at the entire franchise, but really that first trilogy, is they realized how likable his approach was, and they actually gave him more of the subsequent movies. Not that the story wasn't about Jack Sparrow to a certain extent in that first one, but he didn't start the film in the first one. It was kind of like we've talked before, some characters, the Hulk being one of them, you just want to use them sparingly or you'll overuse them and people won't like them anymore. And I think that if you look at the entire franchise, yes, Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow is the draw for sure. But when you put too much of the story in his hands, you're getting too much of a good thing and it's no longer a good thing and you get kind of tired of it.
Very easily. And unfortunately with this film, that's one of the gems, I think one of the more brighter gems of the first film, that, like I was saying, you have a good balance of characters. You can actually acknowledge that you've experienced the journey for Will Turner. You've experienced the journey for Elizabeth Swann.
Absolutely.
And you've experienced the journey for Jack Sparrow, as well as encountering great characters such as Barbossa and Norrington, who's the...
Right.
You know,
who reappears regularly throughout the franchise.
True. Once it hits into that second film, however, and the third film, the focus begins to pan more towards Jack Sparrow and his ability to create antics and opportunities where he can do his hijinks or whatever. It almost becomes like a Pink Panther type of film where your focus is now on one character as opposed to, well, what just happened to all the development we did with in the first film with all these other characters whom have interesting backstories and have interesting arcs, but the focus is now, oh, wait, but we're going to watch this scene where Jack is looking at a ship and he's licking a rock. It doesn't fully make a lot of sense cinematically other than, oh, we can make money off of him.
Right.
Let's put him more on the... He became what Robert Downey Jr. became for the Iron Man portion and in the MCU. He became the character. He became infamous as only being that character, and it's difficult right now to see that particular actor do anything else.
It's entirely impossible in some ways to separate the character and the performer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I'd say in both cases, both Robert Downey Jr., you just mentioned, and Johnny Depp. I mean, subsequent roles for Johnny Depp, you mentioned The Lone Ranger, right?
Yeah.
I don't care what kind of background the character is supposed to have or how, you know, this expert performer performed him differently. But what is it, Tonto?
Yes.
You see Jack Sparrow. I couldn't really watch the movie seriously because I saw Jack Sparrow, not Johnny Depp. I saw Jack Sparrow playing Tonto.
Yeah, there wasn't that dividing line that separates an actor's performances from one to the next. I mean, yes, there was a lull that we hit during the early 90s where a lot of those 90s actors pretty much did the same role each and every time they were on screen. You know, take people like Kevin Costner and Keanu Reeves and a lot of those, you know, names. But then essentially what created method acting, which is what we were talking about, what created great actors, what really strived to set actors apart from other people was their ability to jump in and out of character roles seamlessly and be able to move on to the next one. We were talking about character actors or method acting earlier outside off the air. And one of the people that we were talking about was Daniel Day-Lewis. One of the people who just excels as an actor, jumping in from being Abraham Lincoln 1 point to the butcher in at another point to being a oil rigger, you know, all these roles that he can play.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis is very well known for his commitment to method acting, which basically for anyone who might not know what that is, it's a term to describe the mindset and practice of a performer who decides that they're going to be in character at all times during a stage production, during a film shoot, like when they're in their trailer, when they're at the craft services table, when they're in the bathroom, they do not come out of the character in order to do, I guess you could say, their normal life stuff while they are on. And Daniel Day-Lewis is very highly regarded because of his commitment to doing that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't really follow the stories. Do they say that Johnny Depp is a method actor? I think
it's one of those things where it's like he does it.
It's almost like a self-expression.
Yeah.
More than it's acting sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Because
he's a weird dude.
He is. We were just...
I mean, we've never met the man, but he strikes me as a weird dude.
We just talked about that, and we were talking to someone who had stated that they thought they had heard that Johnny Depp went a little, you know, off his rocker after playing this same role for so long. It's interesting because you look at everything else he does, and it doesn't compare to how much it seems like he invests every time he portrays this character. Like, he's done several films from that god-awful Willy Wonka movie to that Shadows in the Dark or Dark Shadows, whatever that was, another Tim Burton movie.
Right, that almost nobody wanted to watch.
Yeah, and then you take the Alice in Wonderland films.
Oy.
And it always seems like they're a half attempt to creating a character, but if it's him wanting to go to the children's hospital to do all these things, he'll, at the drop of a hat, be able to jump into character and be Jack Sparrow without any kind of, you know, encouragement or whatnot. It's just him showing up and, oh, where's all the rum? You know, he does this whole spiel. And it's like, it almost becomes a, you know, worrisome point for a lot of people in terms of, can he separate himself from the character? And,
well, he just didn't. The choices that, and this is a way deviation from talking about the franchise.
True.
We're just really focusing on the celebrity. But I think that he didn't necessarily do as much as he could have to differentiate his other performances outside of Jack Sparrow. So that kind of perfect storm of, as a franchise, they're going to do more of a Jack Sparrow-focused story, which by definition makes it more campy. Mm-hmm. Because in the first one, it was more balanced in the sense that you had a bunch of other characters who were a lot more serious, and they were taking the situation seriously. Not that he always wasn't.
True.
You know, but you need that. You need the comedy and the drama, if you will, to balance each other out, or else you just end up with a cornball flick, which I would argue is a lot of the third one.
And it's not like the first film, it goes back to balance. It's not like the first film didn't properly use the style of character that he was well. You had it in brief moments. You had it in you had it spread out throughout the entire film. You didn't get all of him all at once. He had a time to shine when they were on that island, and that was his moment. But it was well done. And then you take it to the second and third, and it just becomes an over, you know, barrage of Jack Sparrow and, oh, by the way, Jack Sparrow here, Jack Sparrow there. Oh, Jack Sparrow. Oh, you said Jack Sparrow. Oh, you know Jack Sparrow?
Right.
It's like, I get it. He's a pirate, but I would rather hear more of the story of Keith Richards as the pirate.
Well, and it's okay, honestly, the story architect inside, it's okay to say this trilogy or this saga altogether, this is a story about Jack Sparrow. That's fine.
Yeah.
But balance him out, because he is, there's a lot going on with him. Even in quiet moments, there's a lot going on with him. If you look just at his makeup and costuming, there's a lot going on if he's sitting still. So, you know, or he's got his eyes closed and he's got a different set of eyes painted on the back of his eyelids, or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, there's always a lot going on with him. So you have a responsibility as the filmmaking team to make sure that there's a lot kind of moving in a different direction in the sense of seriousness, maybe even, dare I say, some placidity or calmness that's going on, because he's got all of his hijinks always going on. But then he has a good heart.
Yeah.
He does make sacrificial choices. He does do admirable things. And those moments, it's harder for those moments to work when all you've seen up to that point is a clown.
Very true. And I probably have to admit, the fact that it still included a lot of the key elements that
made... Nothing against clowns, by the way.
Everything against clowns. No, but I think to the film's credit, to the trilogy's credit, it did still keep the key elements that made the first film so great, in terms of just having, you know, Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley's character still continue on through the franchise and give closure to their arcs, as well as having Barbossa come back.
And which kind of didn't make sense, and yet also was completely delightful.
True. It was one of those, let's throw that at the end and kind of, you know, cap off the second film. But hey, I was all for it. It wasn't until jumping into that fourth film that it kind of took a left turn to Poopyville.
Poopyville, eh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of films.
I thought
they
were trying to go to the Fountain of Youth.
Either way, they all live in the same place. So the fourth film, like Chad said, it removed all elements. Of
surprise,
Will Turner and Elizabeth Swann. So you don't have any of them in there. There's a mention of them here and there, But a lot of the characters that you remember from that film, aside from Barbossa and obviously Jack Sparrow, didn't make into that film. So you didn't have Commodore Norrington. You didn't have Will Turner. You didn't have Elizabeth Swann. You didn't.
I thought Norrington was
in that film.
In
that's in the third film.
Yeah, that's true. He's in the third film. No, who is it that they bring? They do bring back somebody. I really thought that he was also in the. Because he kind of like swears off Elizabeth Swann. Mm-hmm. I really thought that he appeared again in the fourth one. Anyway, I could be wrong.
He comes back in the second film.
Again, we didn't rewatch it before doing this show.
He comes back to the second film, showing him that he has the heart of Davy Jones. And then that's when the whole battle goes on for who has the heart. That whole wheel scene that you were talking about, that's in the third film. So the fourth film literally takes just this right turn to somewhere else and completely kind of removes the film from the track that it was on, which, mind you, that's what you do when you're creating a new trilogy of sorts, or you're creating a new saga that's, you know, going to be its own storyline. You obviously have to remove it from there, but it removed it entirely, and I don't know if that direction was the optimal direction that they wanted to essentially first go, because the way the film goes, a lot of the characters I didn't really want to see come back. Aside from Ian McShane. Ian McShane's always great.
Yeah, he's completely watchable all the time.
But, I mean, Penelope Cruz's character, forgettable. A lot of the new crew that Jack Sparrow had, don't remember their names. Gibbs wasn't in that crew. He wasn't there.
He was in the film. He was in the beginning, I know. He came to rescue him from the courthouse.
That's right, that's right. But like a lot of the crew, like the guy who had the wooden eye and the,
sure, yeah,
a lot of those characters, they don't make that cut. And so the reasons as to why I continued watching two and three after one, there was no reason to come back to the fourth film for me. I saw it, but it just, the draw for me wasn't there.
I was going to say, I also saw it, but I don't think I saw it in the theater. I think I saw it later after it was available on DVD. Like I think I rented it from Redbox or something. It wasn't something that appealed to, I didn't think it was going to be any good.
No,
and I mean, to extrapolate even further, neither of us have seen the fifth film yet.
No.
And to me personally, the reason why I haven't seen it yet is because, again, it feels like it doesn't matter. Like, this should have, the best parts are behind us. Unless you're going to give us something
substantial
better,
and much,
and there's improved. No indication that that's what's happening.
Yeah,
you know, neither from the marketing materials nor from the critical response. Okay, well then there's no it's fine. I'm fine not watching it.
Do you think that the franchise itself was marred by the fourth film? Do you think the fourth film, because of how it came across and what was in it, and how it transgressed, do you think that was like kind of like, since we're using nautical terms, the black spot for the franchise?
You know, for me personally, I don't know that I'm qualified to really judge the market as a whole. For me personally, it was marred by the ending of the third film. I hated that.
Oh.
It was completely unrealistic. And I know, I get it. Ghost zombie pirates and, you know, and ghost zombie monkey pirates. Pirate monkeys or whatever. Like, I get it. The whole thing has a weird supernatural, larger than life, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
The whole, like, council of the different pirate lords or kings or whatever they were called with their giant boat city thing in the ocean. I get it. There's a lot of just fictional lark, you know.
Yeah.
But that ending of that third film was so, it went on for so long. I mean, literally, you're in giant ships spinning like mad through a whirlpool,
yeah,
swinging across to each other. There was something about, I don't know if it was the physics of it. It was definitely, for me, the CGI. Not that the CGI was poorly done, but the fact that they relied so heavily on CGI,
yeah.
One of the things that really worked about the first film for me was the amount of practical effects and practical stunt work.
Oh, yeah.
That was done. They used CGI very sparingly overall compared to what they could have done and compared to what they did in the other films later on. Here again, the fifth film, You've got Javier Bardem and his weird Davy Jones-like face, like he's completely CGI.
Yeah.
So it just it's not appealing to me in the same way as we were talking earlier about that textural, you know, that Gore Verbinski kind of, you know, just really a lot of relatable, believable grit.
And I think that that also...
So for me, it went off track with the end of the third film. I was way over it.
Yeah.
About 20 minutes before the end of that film.
And I think I have to agree with you on that in terms of you set the rules in the first film.
Yes.
So you lay the groundwork and you set the rules and you say, okay, yes, this is obviously a fantastical film about pirates and obviously zombie pirates who come back to, you know, from the dead to look for somebody in a coin or whatnot. So yeah, you're setting those limits. You're like, all right, this is the world that this will exist in. But then you start jumping to things like Krakens, and then you start jumping into things like, you know, Davy Jones, which with his overly CGI'd head, which, mind you, honestly, if I would have had just Bill Nye, if I would have seen Bill Nye's frame and make him kind of like how they did Barbossa.
Right.
As Davy Jones, he's just as intimidating in person by himself without all the tentacle work and whatnot.
And nothing against the effects artists.
No,
because
not
they
at
did
all.
A phenomenal job
yeah.
with the effects of all the films. It was the reliance on visual effects
yeah.
increasing with each installment that was really off-putting to me.
And you had, so going back to that first film, you had a great ending that didn't rely. Obviously, there was some CGI because you had to do the integration with the living actor and
right.
then transitioning to the skeleton actor and whatnot. And even when Jack Sparrow does that same thing and he has his coin and he's doing whatever, whatnot. You do have those moments, but the scene itself has a sense of you know, tactile. It has a sense of
sure.
physicality to it. There's a sense of, okay, they are actually at a place. They're actually fighting on probably a faux mountain of coins. They're doing all these things. So, yeah, okay, I can see how that can be a climactic point. Then you jump ahead, and like you were saying with the second film, fighting the Kraken and how that just goes a step above realism and or the, any of the rules that were being set. And you're like, right. okay. And then you take the third film, which essentially jumps off of the boat of the rules that were set, and you have pretty much this, like you said, this fantastical, unrealistic, according to the rules, fight sequence at the very end where Cirque du Soleil is
right.
you know, having a go at all the pirates and the Armada and whatnot. It does,
and you
lose.
Have so many story elements that are trying to
yeah.
tie themselves up. In addition to like the super weird reveal. I mean, Tia Dalma growing and becoming sea monster late. That was to me very weird.
Yeah, which. Yeah, that was kind of out of left field. Like, okay, how was that supposed to fit in? But with that, and then the storyline with Will Turner and his dad, and then Davy Jones and Jack Sparrow, and then the Armada and the heart of Davy Jones, and
Elizabeth and Jack, what's going on with Barbossa, and all kinds of things.
Whatever love triangle between Elizabeth, Jack, and Will, and
weird.
Yeah, it's. There's so much going on that you begin to lose a lot of your core audience and what they were trying, what they at essentially came into the franchise excited for. You begin to start melting down a lot of the foundation that you had set, like, okay, we're from here to here. Well, let's add another piece here. Let's add some more pieces here. And ultimately, you get a film that steers so far away from the first film that... I mean, yeah, it made for great eye candy. I mean, if at that, it made for great, you know, viewing pleasure.
Sure.
But in terms of what greatness I expected and came out of from the first film, it didn't really follow that all the way through.
Yeah.
And then the swan dive with that last film, you know, part four, it just, is there... any kind of redemption, do you think? Is there any possibility for a redemption in this franchise?
I don't think so. I think that... I think its best days are behind it. I think its best days have always been behind it. I still think There were enjoyable elements in the second and third film. There were a few enjoyable morsels in the fourth one. And I'm sure there's a morsel or two again in the fifth one, but the first one was still so much better. In my opinion, it was so much better than the ones that came after it. And honestly, it's the same problem that I had with The Matrix versus The Matrix Revolutions and The Matrix Reloaded and then The Matrix Revolutions. You know, and a lot of my issues are actually the same with The Matrix. Yes, you had a good amount of visual effects. You had a tremendous stunt team on that film and like new filmmaking style that you'd never seen with the whole bullet time thing and all that. Yeah. But then you go immediately into the second film and what did you do? You put everything into a computer and you've got all kinds of fake people fighting like they're part of a video game.
In a film franchise, mind you, that is based on the idea of breaking out of the computer world.
Yeah, and it just...
I find the irony.
It was, funny. Again, the visual effects team, it's not their fault that I don't like those other movies because we relied too much on visual effects. They did a serviceable job and sometimes a great job with the effects that they did. Same here with Pirates. It's the reliance on... You started something with a lot of physical stunt work, choreography, and believability that lends credibility to the you don't have to suspend your disbelief so far.
Yeah.
Then you get into the follow-ups, and you've got all of this extra computer-generated imagery introducing itself into the world, and now you have to suspend your disbelief a whole lot more. And clearly with the first one, you proved that you don't have to do that to make the franchise work. Something like Star Wars, nowadays, the newer Star Wars, that's fine. A bunch of alien races, a bunch of spaceships, you get it. Like, puppets are only going to take you so far. They don't work anymore, really. And so it makes sense for that world to have a lot of visual effects, or that universe. But Pirates just didn't need as much as was put into it. In my opinion.
You know what? For me, I think I'm going to have to say that there is a possibility for the redemption of this franchise. Mostly because of the fact that, you're right, I don't think any film they do in the near future or in any future is going to top the first film. Plain and simple. But I still would like to have a revisit of what made that first film so successful to me, which was a well balance of characters and creating a cohesive storyline that goes from A to B without veering off and doing all these, you know, crazy hijinks or super focus on Jack Sparrow here or doing all that. If they can do that, if they can really wrangle it in and just focus on creating just a beautiful story that has a beginning and end, I think I could be on board for that. So,
I think those are really big ifs at this point.
It's true. Those are big ifs. But
also, while it's clear that the story to this point has been really about Jack Sparrow, I think they need a different focal character if they're going to move forward.
True.
Not that people don't still like Jack Sparrow or that he doesn't have his moments. I think overall, the dividing line between character and performer is way blurred. The performer is kind of out of favor at the moment for his real world behavior. And if you're going to really try to reinvigorate the franchise, you need to have a different character as the centerpiece. And that's a really hard shift.
Yeah, I can 100% agree with you on that. I am done with having the entire film primarily focused on solely Jack Sparrow. So that's why I say if the film can take a hard right back from where it was currently at and really put it back on the track of where one and maybe two kind of built up, then I'm all for it. But hey, here's to hoping, right? So with that, that about wraps up this conversation. Let us know what you think. If you're a fan of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, let us know in the comments on our Facebook page at facebook.com/philosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. And let us know, do you agree? Do you disagree?
Yeah, are these just like your favorite films and you can't wait for the next one to come out every time?
And mind you, we're not experts in this franchise. We see it as we see it and we take it as what comes. And sometimes we have to have people like we've had previously with like Trent and other individuals who have been on the show to help shed a little bit more light on a franchise that we're not fully knowledgeable in. And maybe there's something we missed. Maybe there's a piece of artistry that really runs through all these films that we're just not getting. Please let us know. I'm all for, you know, learning more.
It has certainly made the ride cooler at Disneyland and Disney World.
It has. And so, you know, yeah. That's true.
I mean, it has. It gives a lot more context. Before, they were these animatronic characters, mm-hmm. and you're on a boat and whatever, but now you kind of feel like you understand the world that they inhabit, and it really has enhanced the, you know, whatever, the five-minute ride experience, however long the ride is, 8 minutes, yeah. Probably something like that.
So, also, let us know if you think we should see this new film. If you've seen it and you're like, oh, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, let us know. So maybe we'll probably decide to do a quick, you know, visit to the theaters and check it out. I mean, who knows? Maybe this might be the film that changes Chad's heart. Who
and
knows?
If we see it and we like it, we'll give you a shout out. Just thank you for prompting us to go and experience that.
Exactly. A couple upcoming, before we close out the show, a couple upcoming weekend releases coming out this Friday. We have It Comes at Night, this upcoming horror film that actually looks kind of interesting.
It does look really good.
And as well, the one that everybody's been talking about, Tom Cruise in The Mummy. So let you know what's coming out. Check it out. Get to your theaters, let us know what you think, and we'll see if we can catch one.
Universal Studios expanding Dark Universe.
Yes, that is totally going to happen. But that wraps up another awesome show. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.